Hello, everyone. Breaking news right now. I am Trish Regan. We are just listening in to Ron DeSantis, who is declaring his bid for the presidency. And he's doing so live right now in a very unusual way on Twitter, on Twitter Spaces. So you can't see him, but there's a conversation that's happening with millions of people right now tuning in. Let's listen in because there's questions being taken. Lots happening. He did speak about the importance of reestablishing our freedoms, and it's one of the reasons he's so motivated to run for president. But I want to bring you right now live to this event so that you can hear for yourself. Let's see if we can pull this up right now. And almost there. Bear with me. I believe that you can see this. I believe that you can hear this as well. So this is coming to us via Twitter Spaces. Let's listen in.
Advocate, that would not be able to happen again on this Twitter platform. So I think what was done with Twitter is really significant for the future of our country. We cannot have a society in which government is colluding with major tech platforms to enforce an orthodoxy.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we're absolutely committed to freedom of speech and a level playing field, and just a vigorous debate. And hopefully this can be a platform that brings people of divergent political views to exchange those views, and perhaps some minds will be changed one way or the other. And but it's just incredibly important, as you highlight, that the First Amendment is irrelevant if all the media and all the and the government are operating in lockstep. It makes the most important amendment, the one that was most urgently added to the Constitution, moot if you cannot have a free and open debate. So Twitter was indeed expensive, but free speech is priceless.
Awesome. Thank you. So, Governor, I'm going to ask some questions while we get some other kind of speakers in the queue to ask questions. I think maybe some people knew this announcement was coming because there's been no shortage of hit pieces on you yeah. in the press over the last week or two. I want to ask you about some of these accusations that are being leveled at you. Last week, the NAACP issued a travel advisory against your state, claiming that Florida is not a safe place for minorities to visit. What do you say to those who've been advised that somehow they aren't welcome in your state?
Claiming that Florida is unsafe is a total farce. I mean, are you kidding me? You look at cities around this country, they are awash in crime. In Florida, our crime rate is at a 50-year low. If you look at the top 25 cities for crime in America, Florida does not have a single one amongst the top 25. And if you look at cities like Baltimore and Chicago, you got kids more likely to get shot than to receive a first-class education. Yet I don't see the NAACP batting an eye about all the outrage and the carnage that's happening in those areas. So this is a political stunt. These left-wing groups have been doing it for many, many years. And at the end of the day, what they're doing is colluding with legacy media to try to manufacture a narrative. Now, the good news is fewer and fewer Americans are gullible enough to believe this dribble. And platforms like Twitter are there where people can debunk these lies in real time. And I would just say, as an American citizen, if you are uncritically accepting narratives spun by legacy media and left-wing groups, you're failing at your job of being a conscientious citizen. And I think people just see right through it. And oh, by the way, have any of these travel advisories, because they've been doing this for a while, these left-wing groups, have any of them worked? Well, we're the number one state for net in-migration and have been every year since I've been governor. We just capped the highest quarter for tourism in the history of the state of Florida. And our view is we want everybody to succeed regardless of their skin color. We don't divvy up people by race. At the same time, it is worth pointing out that we have in Florida more Black-owned businesses than any state in the nation. And we've also had more African-Americans lead state agencies under my administration than at any time in Florida history. But with us, you know they're there because of merit, not because we're trying to play identity politics. And if you want to look at education, the Black students in Florida perform much higher than Black students in most other states. We rank number 3 in fourth grade reading and number 2 in fourth grade math amongst our Black student population. And oh, by the way, the head of the NAACP lives in Florida, and a lot of their board members have put out on social media during my governorship Florida vacations where they seem to be having an awful good time.
That's great. Well, I mean, Florida's a great state, and I think everyone, the people realize that. Some of the things that are being said are just truly absurd. I mean, I saw some headline from The Atlantic basically claiming that anyone who listens to this Spaces on Twitter is basically a Nazi.
That was The Atlantic. Vanity Fair said that that you were hosting or interviewing because David Duke wasn't available.
Oh, yes.
I'm not totally sure who they were saying was David Duke. I don't know if it was you or Governor DeSantis. It's sort of a little bit unclear. But I
think this is a function of the legacy media, these corporate journals. They're in their little bubble. And to draw allusions to stuff like that, I mean, how crazy do you have to be? But in their little bubble, it sounds like they're making some type of profound point. And so part of, I think, what Twitter is standing for is people should be exposed to different viewpoints. And I think the elites in our society have tried to cluster themselves to where their assumptions are never challenged. And that's not a good way, I think, to live. It's also not a good way to be a critical thinker, because no one's ever going to question obviously wrong assumptions because everybody around you shares them.
Absolutely.
And I think they become totally hysterical because they don't like the idea that their control over the media is being, you know, disintermediated.
Yeah.
Because now, you know, candidates for president can just speak directly to people through platforms like Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing about Twitter and things like Spaces are that, although I happen to be hosting it, I had to switch over to David hosting it because my account was actually
just too much interest.
But, my account was breaking the system. There's really never been a mechanism before where someone could address the nation or anyone who wanted to listen to them could from anywhere in the world. United States or anywhere. So this is a really profound change. And it's also like it's not just whether the media reports something and an article is true or not. Even more powerful is deciding what the narrative is. And it's just like if there's only so much you can actually fit in a newspaper or a magazine, and there's only one thing you can really put on the cover of a magazine. So that whoever's deciding that is deciding to not talk about other things. Whereas with a public digital town square like we have here, it's possible for the public to choose the narrative. It empowers the people instead of a very tiny elite cabal, which I don't recognize the irony of me using that phrase. But nonetheless, it's true. And you judge by the results that this is a means for the people to decide the narrative and for the people to decide which way a debate will go, not sort of five editors in chiefs of a few newspapers, basically.
Yeah, and I think one of the really crazy things that happened during COVID is that social networks really started censoring dissenting viewpoints on COVID, medical viewpoints that ended up being totally correct in lockstep with what the mainstream media was doing. So basically, big tech platforms were undermining their main reason for existing, which is giving people a choice. And actually, there's somebody who I think knows more about that than any of us, which is Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who's a professor of medicine at Stanford. I want to pull him in here. Jay, you go ahead and unmute yourself if you can. It'd be great to hear from you. I know that during COVID, you worked with Governor DeSantis. It'd be great just to hear a little bit about your interactions and if you have a question for the governor.
Thank you, David. Yeah, I mean, it was an absolute honor to work with Governor DeSantis. And I was really impressed by his decision making in the face of an absolute firestorm of criticism. But he, you know, Governor, you did the right thing when you opened the schools. And my kids in California for a year and a half didn't see the inside of a classroom, whereas Florida kids were in school. And you can see it in the results, and the learning loss numbers are so much better in Florida. I'm really curious, Governor, you know, as you're running for president, what are your thoughts about reforming, you know, the public health authority in the United States and the federal government, the, you know, the CDC, the FDA, the NIH? How do you see reforms we need so that the mistakes of the lockdowns that happened during the pandemic don't happen again when there's another pandemic?
Well, first, we need an honest reckoning about what happened during COVID. And the only honest reckoning is that all of those agencies, all of the elites, the public health establishment, they failed. They instituted bad policies. Obviously, it's a novel virus, but I think what happened was when the data was becoming more and more apparent that the path they were on was wrong, they doubled down and wanted to do it even more. And I really believe had Florida not just kind of stood in the way, I think this country would have had rolling lockdowns for probably a two-year period. And so their impulses were authoritarian. They were not following the data. And I think the U.S. government needs to acknowledge the failures. And I think all of those agencies need to be cleaned out. What I saw just dealing with them was I saw a interest in the narrative and in politics over evidence-based reasoning and evidence-based medicine. And so I don't have confidence that those agencies are up to the task. And I think you need major, major overhaul of the whole enchilada with respect to public health in this country.
Can I follow up with that? I mean, I think the other thing that I saw during the pandemic, Governor, and you was subject to it just as much as I was when we were talking about COVID. YouTube censored a video of us speaking about in a roundtable that you hosted on COVID policy. There's so much of the federal government infrastructure went into suppressing honest scientific discussion during the pandemic. So it's not just public health agencies, but other agencies inside the federal government that worked to suppress the speech of Americans. And I'd love to hear
no
your
question.
Thoughts about it.
No question. So I'm actually in Florida. We recognize the danger there. So I'm actually going to be signing a digital bill of rights for Florida pretty soon, which will bar all state and local government officials from colluding or working with a technology company for the purpose of censorship of speech. Because you're exactly right. You had people in the White House, you had people in all these other agencies working with these platforms to try to take it down. And oh, by the way, what did they censor Dr. Bhattacharya for? It was a roundtable discussion that I led and convened. We had Dr. Bhattacharya, MD, PhD from Stanford. We had Martin Kulldorff from Harvard Medical School, and we had Sunetra Gupta from Oxford, who was generally viewed as one of the best epidemiologists across the pond until she became anti-lockdown. So these are all eminent people. And what are we discussing? We're discussing whether there's any scientific basis to force a school child to wear a mask for 8 hours a day. They all agreed there was no basis to do it and that you should not have school mask mandates. YouTube thought that was, quote, anti-science, and that should be taken down. But even at that point, we had already had enough experience in Florida where you had some schools that had done it before the state banned the mandates. You had some schools that had done it, some schools didn't, and the results were no different. And yet his video was taken down by Google, YouTube. So it was a huge, huge problem. And yes, I think the federal government, FBI, DHS, any of the health agencies, it's unconstitutional for them to be delegating speech restriction to a private company. You can't do indirectly what the Constitution would clearly forbid you to do directly.
Let me pull in. We have Congressman Thomas Massey. If you're there, go ahead and unmute yourself. I mean, what we're talking about here is, I think, really unconstitutional actions by federal agencies. Congressman Massey, I know that you've been involved in this problem of, you know, government agencies being weaponized and used against the American people in an inappropriate way. Do you have a comment on this? And do you have a question for Governor DeSantis?
Well, first of all, let me say a big thank you to Elon Musk for buying Twitter and exposing all of this. On our weaponization committee, we wouldn't know so much of it if he hadn't done this, almost as a public service to the First Amendment. It's a disturbing trend. Government, as the governor said, the government is colluding with big corporations. We found out this week from an FBI whistleblower that Bank of America voluntarily gave names of information on anybody who bought a hot dog in Washington, D.C. from January 5th to January 7th, and then overlaid that with gun purchases that they had on record anywhere in the country for any period of time. And just they say they voluntarily gave that to the FBI. So that's disturbing to me. By the way, I've never met Elon Musk, but I'm one of your biggest fans. I'm the first congressman to have a Tesla. I'm on Starlink, and I would have bought a Powerwall, but I'm off the grid, and you wouldn't sell me one, so I had to make one with a wrecked Model S, and it's been running our house for 5 years. But
and just for the record, I was with Thomas our first year in Congress. He's got the Tesla, but his license plate is Kentucky Coal. So it's he's probably one of the only people that have that in the country.
Thanks for outing me, Governor DeSantis. Governor DeSantis, my question to you is, you know, you served here in Congress for 6 years with me. And why is it that Congress is so feckless at reining in these government agencies? And what do you think we need to do? And if you were president, what would you urge Congress, or what bills would you like to see and sign to rein in this, sort of overreach of government bureaucracy?
Well, first, I think there's a lot that the executive branch can do. And I will say when it comes to these agencies, we'll go into this a little bit more as the campaign goes on. But buckle up when I get in there, because the status quo is not acceptable. And we are going to make sure that we reconstitutionalize this government. And these agencies are totally out of control. There's no accountability. And we are going to bring that in a very big way. Now, part of the reason it's gotten so bad, power has been consolidated and effectively a fourth branch of government, because Congress hasn't used its two main powers that it has under the Constitution. First, the power of the purse. If an agency is engaging in conduct that is outside the realm of what is legal, or you think it's not good for the public interest, then you can remove the funding for those operations. There's nothing that they're not entitled to get the same level of funding every year. And yet Congress runs the government on autopilot, either continuing resolutions or massive omnibus spending bills. So these agencies are all bulletproof. They know that they're going to end up getting something similar or more every single year. And it creates an incentive for them to abuse their power. The other thing you can do is actually legislate, so you're not delegating to the bureaucracy key issues regarding how to enforce federal law. You should define what you want. All they should be doing is implementing. Instead, Congress will basically give an invitation for the bureaucracy to make really important substantive decisions. And so Congress may never vote on something, and the bureaucracy will cite a law from 20 years ago and do things that are going to transform our society or our country. That is not the way the founding fathers drew up the Constitution.
So would you sign the Reins Act? We passed it out of Judiciary today.
Oh, yeah. No, of course. Yeah, that's a no-brainer. That would, I think, be a great check for that. I also think that we're going to have a good chance to see some of the Chevron deference really curtailed or maybe even eliminated based on the U.S. Supreme Court's upcoming jurisprudence. And I think that's another reason why the bureaucracy has become so powerful, because courts have basically been told they can pretty much do what they want, and courts are supposed to just defer. I don't think that that's actually correct. I think the courts, they have to make a judgment about what does the law actually say, and you can't just defer to quote unquote experts in the bureaucracy.
Thank you.
All right, shifting gears, Governor, I want to ask you another topic that's been in the news a lot is Disney. They blamed you for canceling plans for $1 billion investment in Florida, said they were canceling 2,000 jobs. I saw other reports that suggested Disney was going to make the cuts anyway, and due to a larger, you know, budget cutting initiative. Regardless of why they did it, why do you feel your fight with Disney remains important, considering you already beat them on the parental rights bill that they opposed? And what would you say to some of your opponents in this race who argue that the fight has dragged on too long?
So first of all, Florida stands for the protection of children. We believe jamming gender ideology in elementary school is wrong. Disney obviously supported injecting gender ideology in elementary school. They did oppose our parents' rights legislation. And the fact is, when they opposed it, that was a big deal, because for 50 years, anytime Disney wanted something in Florida politics, they pretty much got it. But not this time. I signed the bill. We did, as you say, win on the issue. But what happened was Disney's posturing, some of the other statements that their executives were making, kind of the corporate culture had really been outed as trying to inject matters of sex into the programming for the youth. And I think a lot of parents, including me, look at that and say, that's not appropriate. I mean, we want our kids to be able to just be kids. And that's kind of our mantra. So you had this setup that Disney engineered many decades ago, where they actually had their own government that they controlled with no accountability. They were exempt from the laws that all their competitors had to follow, massive tax breaks, and they even racked up municipal debt. And Florida basically put them on a pedestal many decades ago and joined the state with this one company at the hip. We just didn't feel that we were comfortable maintaining that relationship. And so we ended their self-governing status. So Disney has to live under the same laws as everybody. They got to pay the same taxes as everybody. And obviously they'll be responsible for those debts. So the reason why there's a quote fight is just because they filed a lawsuit against the state of Florida trying to get their special privileges reinstituted. But I don't think that that's good policy. And I think some of these Republicans that are taking Disney's side, they're basically showing themselves to be corporatists, because these are all corporate goodies. This is not the way you would run a competitive economy. And the arrangement had really outlived its usefulness, but it persisted because Disney was so politically powerful. I think the company's ethos have changed in a way that's alienated a lot of people in our legislature and in Florida. And so there was really no justification to keep it. But make no mistake, they're suing to try to get special privileges. People are making money in Florida hand over fist because we have a great business climate. That's not good enough for them. They want to be treated differently than Universal and SeaWorld, and we don't think that that's appropriate. So, you know, I think that they should withdraw the lawsuit, but obviously we're going to defend our actions because we think we have the right to do what we did.
You know, it's funny, the media used to criticize Republicans for being in the pocket of big corporations, and now they're attacking you because you're not.
Well, not only that, David, it's interesting because the media in Florida for years had hammered Disney, and they would point out like that this was not a good arrangement, because you know Disney was not accountable to anyone. I mean, when the state control board took over this district, the firefighters came to the board and they said, hey, we weren't getting survivor benefits for some of these widows. And so the state control board actually paid out some of the benefits that they were getting stiffed on. There were a lot of people in Central Florida who were really thankful that there was some accountability being brought to bear, because, I mean, you know, it's human nature. If there's no accountability over any individual or entity, of course, they're going to behave differently than if you have normal accountability. But the media was always very hostile to that. But just because I happened to be involved in bringing it back to reality and making sure that they were under the same laws, well, then all of a sudden they're running to Disney's defense. I mean, are you kidding me? And oh, by the way, on this project, you know, they had announced this many years ago. They had not done anything for it, but that is actually not in Reedy Creek. So that was in a different part of Orlando. And so none of the issues that are involved in their suit would have made a difference there. Obviously, as a publicly traded corporation, you know, they have a fiduciary duty to do what's best for their shareholders. So I'm assuming if they were in better financial shape and they saw the project as lucrative, they would have gone forward with it. But I think clearly they've had some problems with their stock price and a lot of other issues. And I'd also just finally point out, nobody probably has made Disney more money than me, because they were open during COVID and they were closed in California. And that went on for many, many months, where literally I had all the theme parks in Florida opened in 2020. People are going, it's safe, they're having fun. And the California parks were closed. I think they were closed for over a year out in California. So we were, I think, a much better place to be doing business, certainly since I've been governor.
Great. Let me shift gears here to the topic of education. I want to pull Chris Rufo into the conversation. I know he'll work with you on some initiatives. I think, you know, one other thing that the mainstream media has, I think, bashed on is they've kind of started promoting this narrative that you want to ban books from school libraries, you refuse to teach kids about slavery or other unpleasant realities of American history. or pretend that gay people don't exist. Since many people, I think, in this room, we're now up to, over 271,000 people. So this is, I think, totally unprecedented in terms of the numbers of people we have participating. By the way, I think Twitter's working much better now. I think it crashed because when you multiply 500,000 people in a room by an account with over 100 million followers, which is Elon's account, I think that created just a scalability level that was unprecedented. But with my meager followership, it seems to be working much better.
We have some scaling issues specifically related to my account. At one point in January, if I tweeted above a certain size, it would crash the servers.
Yeah.
And then anyone else who was tweeting at the same time would lose their tweet as well.
Yeah. Well, we're breaking new ground here.
We're scaling issues.
Yes, you know you're breaking new ground when there are bugs and scaling issues. But in any event, back to the question I was asking you, Governor DeSantis, about education. The media has been, saying you're trying to ban books, you refuse to teach kids about slavery, you want to say that gay people don't exist. What is the truth of the matter for people who maybe have never heard from you before? And then I want to pull Chris Rufo in on this as well.
Yeah, so the whole book ban thing is a hoax. There's not been a single book banned in the state of Florida. You can go buy or use whatever book you want. What we have done is empowered parents with the ability to review the curriculum, to know what books are being used in school, and then to ensure that those books match state standards and are age and developmentally appropriate. So, for example, parents have flagged books in schools that, for example, teach middle school kids how to use sex apps, that provide graphic depictions of sex acts and sex toys for people as young as fifth grade. And so clearly that is not appropriate to be in a middle school classroom. And so parents object and the schools take them out. I did a press conference that we called Exposing the Book Ban Hoax. And before I had the parents come up, before I spoke, I just played the video that had the images of the books that the parents had objected being in their kids' classroom. And the local news had to cut the feed because they said it was too graphic. Well, if it's too graphic for the 6 o'clock news, how is it okay for a sixth grader or a fifth grader? And so nothing's being banned. They're basically ensuring that we make curation choices that are consistent with state standards. And on the racial history, we eliminated critical race theory from our K through 12 schools. That was the right thing to do. In other words, we're not going to take a kid who comes in at 6 years old and say they're an oppressor or oppressed based on what their race is. That's divisive. That's wrong. We're also not going to be teaching people to hate their country. But what we are going to do is teach the accurate history. So in the same bill that banned critical race theory, we required teaching thoroughly about racial discrimination that occurred in American history, and Florida's history standards require all of those subjects from slavery, Reconstruction, segregation, all of that to be taught, and we'll continue to do that. So I think what you see is the left and the media colluding on this. They don't want to actually defend what it is that we are actually legislating or regulating, so they create these hoaxes that somehow you don't want kids to learn that slavery existed in America, which is preposterous. No one actually defends the offending material. And the question is why are there people intent on trying to get this stuff into the classroom? And I think it's part of a political agenda. So our mantra in Florida is this purpose of the schools is education, not indoctrination. Yes, I think it's very inappropriate to have sexually explicit material in a fifth grade library, 100%. But it's also the case that if you're focusing on that type of instruction, there's an opportunity cost involved. Why shouldn't we be doing more on science or reading or math? And so I think we're getting it right. And I think almost invariably, and Chris Rufo's had to deal with this too, when they're trying to craft these narratives, if you just peel back the onion, you realize that this is something they're manufacturing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was actually under the impression that there were some books banned. So this is news to me.
The one this week was that Miami-Dade County took a book that was about like poems from I think like Biden's inauguration, and they moved it from elementary school library to middle school library. The media tried to act like somehow this is being banned, and you actually had Miami-Dade County Public Schools spokesperson have to come out and say there's nothing that's been banned or removed. It was basically just determined that this particular book was better suited for middle school. And so they put it in the middle school media center. And the media tries to act like somehow that is offending something with a book ban. So, but I think part of the reason that they're doing that is because, you know, there is actually a movement to ban books from like Amazon and some of these others. California, some municipalities have banned things like To Kill a Mockingbird. What they're trying to do is see if some of these books pass a woke test. And if they don't, they are going against some of those books. Whereas in Florida, you can buy whatever book you want. But that's a different question than what would be appropriate for a third grader or what would be appropriate for a sixth grader. Government, by definition, has to make those choices about what type of curriculum we want to put in front of our students. And the parents obviously have an important voice in that.
Absolutely. Well, in fact, a friend of mine, Tim Urban, who has a blog called Wait, Wait, But Why, and is really one of the most reasonable people on earth and one of the most reasoned people I've ever met, had a lot of trouble actually publishing his book, simply because it debated sort of sacred cows of woke ideology. But incredibly reasonable book. So that is the kind of de facto book banning and de facto book suppression that I see quite a lot of, is that publishers are unwilling to take risks.
Let me shift gears here for a second, because I know we're running out of time. We're supposed to end, I think, around 4, but 4 Pacific. But thank you for giving us a little bit extra time here, Governor. Shifting gears to a major federal issue, immigration. We see I've seen these videos on social media and on TV of what looks like just insanity at the border. What is your take on what's going on there, and how would you address that as president?
Well, I'd reverse what Biden's doing. You need to shut the border down. You should not be entertaining these asylum claims for people crossing illegally. Now, asylum is a legitimate thing, but these are people that when they come, I mean, they're being persecuted. These people come in overwhelmingly are economic migrants that are coming across many other different countries. They should be applying for asylum there if they were, you know, truly qualifying for that, but they're not. They know that if they just show up at the southern border, and these are people all over the world that are coming illegally, they know that they will get a sheet of paper saying, okay, come back for a court date in 3 years, and they get released to the interior of our country. It's an absolutely insane system. So we'll stop that. We will move on day one by declaring a national emergency. We will construct a border wall. We will make sure we have remain in Mexico and that we're not entertaining those claims in that way. And we really need to hold the Mexican drug cartels accountable, because they're facilitating a lot of this migration. They obviously make money off of it. They treat a lot of these people very horribly as they're trafficking them through Mexico and into the United States. And of course, the cartels have been responsible for moving massive amounts of fentanyl into this country. And that's killing tens of thousands of Americans every year now. And what they're doing is they lace the other types of drugs with the fentanyl. So you may have like a teenage kid doing something they probably shouldn't do, but in prior generations would not have been fatal. And now if it's laced with fentanyl, you know, these kids can overdose and die. And so mothers are losing kids as a result of this fentanyl epidemic. And I just don't think you could allow these criminal organizations to continue poisoning our population. So it'll be a day one issue. We will bring an overwhelming amount of resources to deal with it. And we are going to stop this insanity once and for all.
There's a, I think, follow-up question on immigration from Steve Dace, who is a national radio personality and I think an important commentator in the great state of Iowa. Steve, do you have a comment or question? I think you just need to unmute. If Steve can unmute, then we'll go ahead and ask him for a question. If not, we'll keep rolling here. All right. Three, two, going, gone.
I'm there,
all right,
guys.
Sorry, Steve.
I'm there, guys. Sorry.
Oh, there you go. All right.
My bad. First of all, I want to echo what Congressman Massey said to Elon. Elon, if I put down money on January 1st, 2022, that Twitter was going to be the last bastion of free speech on Earth, brother, I'd be about as rich as you are on that bet right now. I mean, it's incredible what you have done here and the restoration of a lot of accounts of people that were truth tellers and were ran from here for telling the truth. I saw a meme the other day that said, of course, you have scientific consensus when you censor all the scientists who disagree. So I wanted to just say, first and foremost, on behalf of a lot of grateful people around the country and the world, really, thank you very much for that and the investment you made in that cause. Thank you. A question is a follow-up to you, Governor, on this very issue with immigration. We have heard a lot over the years, lock her up, drain the swamp, going to build a beautiful wall. Mexico's going to pay for it. And crowds cheered and everybody loved it. And brands got built and nothing got done. What is the bottom line assurance that you can make to the people that are listening right now all over the world and all over the country that you can actually do the agenda that you just articulated when others tweeted about it and talked about it, but then couldn't actually follow through?
It's a great question because I share that frustration. I think even my worst critics in Florida will acknowledge when I tell people I'm going to do something, I don't make promises or say I'm going to do something lightly. I've thought it through, and I know that I am going to follow through on what I tell people I'm going to do. So this is one, there will be follow through. Number two, I understand the different leverage points that you would have under Article 2 of the Constitution. I studied that a lot at becoming governor about Florida's Constitution, doing the same thing for the federal Constitution. And you've got to know how to use your leverage to advance what you're trying to accomplish. So, for example, you know, there's leverage that we can use vis-a-vis Mexico that I think presidents have not been willing to do, I think sometimes for political purposes. But I'll look at, okay, what are all the variety of options we can do? Which buttons can I push? And I will do that to be able to bring this issue to a conclusion once and for all. We had Hurricane Ian come through Southwest Florida, Category 4 plus storm, September of 2022, and it did a lot of damage. But one of the things it did, it knocked out a bridge going from the mainland to Pine Island, and it severed the Sanibel Causeway in three different locations. And the locals were being told it's going to take 6 months to get that stuff repaired. And so they came to me, even though these were not state-owned bridges, and they said, can you help us? And I said, okay, I'll do it. So I got my guys together. I said, listen, no bureaucracy, no red tape, and no excuses. Get it done. We need to open these bridges back. Pine Island Bridge reopened 3 days later. Sanibel Causeway opened 2 weeks after that, way, way ahead of schedule, because we wouldn't take no for an answer, and we wanted to make sure we got it done. So for me, it is not a campaign slogan that you get in and then forget about it. I'm, as an American citizen, if I wasn't running, this would be an issue that bothers me. I've put a lot of my capital as Florida governor involved in combating illegal immigration. We banned sanctuary cities my first year. We just did a strong anti-illegal immigration bill in Florida that's working. I put marine assets in the Florida Keys to help the Coast Guard repel boats from places like Haiti. I had people at the southern border right now helping Texas, and we've even been able to relocate illegal aliens to places like Martha's Vineyard. So I don't think any governor has probably gone out of his way to do more to try to make an impact on this issue. And I'm not going to take no for an answer. And I think our voters are sick of the empty promises. They want to see action.
Thank you, Governor.
Well, Governor, I saw the cover of Time Magazine this week. And I think they were trying to do a negative story because they had you were sort of scowling in this portrait they made of you. And in the article, they call you they compared you to the Terminator. And I think they meant insult, but I thought it was kind of cool. I thought it was a good thing because I think we need a cool-headed, ruthless assassin to go in and basically take on the woke mob, take on our out-of-control government, and take on problems like the ones at the border. So, again, I thought it made you sound great, even though that may not have been their intention.
Well, look, at the end of the day, this whole business that we're in is about producing results. I don't care about fanfare. you know, I'm the governor, like that is, I'm known, right? And I go around the state and everything. And people are very nice. And so, I mean, I appreciate the well wishes, but I don't need any of the fanfare. I don't need any adulation. I just know I'm in a position where I have a chance to make a difference, and I'm either doing it or I'm not. And I remember sitting at the desk in the state capitol my first day as governor 4.5 years ago. I looked around the room and I thought to myself, I don't know what SOB is going to succeed me in this chair, but they are not going to have anything to do because I'm getting all the meat off the bone. I am going to make sure that I'm leaning into issues and making an impact. And we have done that in the state of Florida. And I bring that exact attitude up to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Governor, I'd love to jump in and follow up on that. This is Chris Rufo. And you know, I've had the honor of working with you in the past few years on critical race theory, gender ideology, and the DEI bureaucracy. And what I've seen up close and personal is that while many conservative politicians going back decades have made headlines and got on television playing culture war, they never actually get anything done. And what you've done over the last few years is really astonishing. You've eliminated CRT from all Florida's public institutions. You've stopped gender ideology dead in its tracks in K-12. And just last week, you eliminated the DEI bureaucracy in all of Florida's public universities. They'll be shut down completely. And I think what you've done is established a blueprint for fighting back against the left's long march of the institutions and making sure that those institutions reflect the value of Florida voters, not left-wing activists and the partisan press. So my question for you is, you know, D.C. is another animal. It's quite different, the scale of the federal government. And how are you going to deliver results? And what is your culture war strategy facing down the swamp in D.C.?
Well, some of it is similar in this respect. When we're taking on things like DEI, you get blowback from legacy media and the far left. But that's an example of an issue where they are out of step with the vast majority of Americans. It's not just Republicans. It's independents and a lot of Democrats, because you think about if you're a parent and you've got kids, you want to know when they apply to college, they're going to be judged based on their merit. And they're not going to be roadkill in some type of woke Olympics where they didn't fit some category. And so they're denied opportunity. They want to make sure that achievement matters. And so we get a lot of quiet support for a lot of those things. And so I think what I do, just because, look, I'm a blue collar kid. I grew up in the Tampa Bay area working minimum wage to get through school. You know, my grandfather worked in the steel mill in Western Pennsylvania. I just know instinctively kind of what like normal people think about all this stuff. And I have a good sense of when the legacy media and the left are outside of where the average American is, because people want you to be using common sense and things like DEI. I mean, when I was growing up, I think things were better because people were actually told you should try to get along. Now they're told you need to segregate. And it's just crazy that they're trying to do all this stuff. So by eliminating that, there's a lot of people that were really happy about that, including people that certainly are not traditional Republicans. And I think there's similar issues when you do in the federal level. It's also the case that there are some tools at the federal level that we don't necessarily have at the state level. For example, some of the problems with the university and the ideological capture that didn't happen by accident can trace back all the way to the accreditation cartels. Well, guess what? To become an accreditor, how do you do that? You've got to get approved by the U.S. Department of Education. So we're going to be doing alternative accreditation regimes where instead of saying you will only get accredited if you do DEI, you'll have an accreditor that will say, we will not accredit you if you do DEI. We want a colorblind, merit-based accreditation scheme. And so as president, controlling that agency, you can then approve other types of accreditation. So I think part of it is just knowing where are all the pressure points. How does it get to the point that we then see and that somebody like you will run a report on? Like when you see some of the outrageous stuff that's generated in some sociology department at a university, that didn't just happen out of thin air. There's a reason why we got to that point. And I think that there are some tools with the federal government where you can push back and try to get these institutions moored in a more foundational direction about, hey, we're pursuing truth here and we're not here to try to impose one niche ideology on the entire student body.
Great. Shifting gears, Dana Lash, you have a question or comment for the governor?
I do. And thank you both so much for your time, for joining us in a very new way. I really appreciate that. I think it's really cool. And for your support of free speech, too. And Elon, I have to say thank you for taking the arrows and for unthrottling the accounts of all of us who got in trouble for sharing a New York Post story about a laptop. And Governor, I wanted to thank you for your leadership and your unwavering support of Second Amendment rights. And you're on my program tomorrow. And I just got to say, you got my vote in the primary. So I appreciate it very much. You were talking about DEI just a minute ago, and I want to ask you both about this growing threat against natural rights and free enterprise. It's this threat of debanking. Now, I know that, you know, Elon, I've read so much about you and what you've gone through. You've called ESG criteria evil incarnate. Governor DeSantis, Florida, saw financially weaponized wokery earlier this year when Wells Fargo Bank dumped both the business and personal accounts of a very prominent and well-respected gun dealer in Florida. They've been together for 25 years working with Wells Fargo, and they cited new ESG guidelines. Now, similar to the DOJ's previous Operation Choke Point, all these activists for various causes are using this regulatory guidance to debank what they consider to be politically incorrect businesses for the sake of risk management. Now, we say that our rights should not be infringed upon by the government, but what can and should be done about activist-guided financial institutions and these, you know, payment processors who are essentially cutting off law-abiding citizens and businesses?
Well, I think it's a fundamental issue that I think not enough conservatives have been wise to. I think more and more are. But at the end of the day, we have certain fundamental rights. And so maybe you're somebody that is really excited about your Second Amendment rights. And obviously, if the government comes in and infringes that, we know you blow the whistle on that. That's a problem. But what if Wall Street banks are colluding so that somebody can't function in that space, whether it's running a store or anything involving that? Your rights are still being infringed upon in that situation. And so I think this whole ESG movement is really trying to do through the financial sector what they could never achieve through the ballot box. And so they're trying to do an end run around the constitutional system, and they're really trying to change policy. They're trying to change society, and they're trying to change the scope of people's rights. And so in Florida, I just signed anti-ESG legislation, which said things like no ESG criteria in our pension fund. We got $180 billion state pension fund. No social credit scores for consumers when they're going to bank. In other words, if you apply for a loan, that loan should be judged based on your creditworthiness, not whether you're genuflecting to the appropriate left-wing causes. But one thing we did do is we did provide protection against this debanking with the woke banking. No discrimination based on your religion and other things, which we know is happening. So I think it's a fundamental question, but we will not be a free society if major financial institutions can do through the economy what people could not achieve through the ballot box. Our rights will be restricted, will be the end result, and that's not healthy for a free country.
You know, as a follow-up to that, Governor, Dana mentioned Operation Choke Point, and that is a term that's very familiar to crypto companies in Silicon Valley and fintech companies. Basically, it refers to an effort by the federal government, including the SEC, to basically regulate blockchain and crypto companies out of existence. They really feel like they're being driven out of the country. And I'm not talking about scammy ones or the totally fake ones like FTX, but really high quality, good companies, including companies that are public like Coinbase. And these guys are basically begging the government for just a framework. They're just like, tell us how to operate legally and we'll do it. I guess where do you come down on this? What is your view, I guess, broadly of Bitcoin and people's right to hold Bitcoin and to transact Bitcoin?
And Dogecoin.
You have every right to do Bitcoin. The only reason these people in Washington don't like it is because they don't control it. And they're central planners, and they want to have control over society. And so Bitcoin represents a threat to them. And so, as you're saying, they're trying to regulate it out of existence. Look, could Congress enact a statute to ban things like Bitcoin under the Constitution? They may be able to do. I would oppose that. I think we should people should be able to do Bitcoin. But Congress has never addressed this in this fashion. And for the bureaucracy to just do it on their own and make it so people can't operate in that space, that's what we mean when we say we've got to return the government to the people's elected representatives who are our voice to be able to make these decisions. And so as president, we'll protect the ability to do things like Bitcoin. I think these are people that are sophisticated. They can make decisions. There's risks involved with it, but let them do that. I just do not have an itch to have to control everything that people may be doing in this space. And I think that the current regime, clearly, they have it out for Bitcoin. And if it continues for another 4 years, you know, they'll probably end up killing it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that is the strong feeling of people in Silicon Valley who are in this space. And I think we'll be heartened to hear your answer on that. I mean, the weird thing is that, and there is a huge constituency of crypto Twitter. So for people who are maybe part of political Twitter who are wondering why we're talking about this, it really is has a big audience for this topic.
Dogecoin too, that's what I have said.
Yeah, Bitcoin and Dogecoin. So shout out to all the Doge fans out there. Yeah. But the weird thing is that this administration, they seem to want to ban Bitcoin, but they want to create a CBDC, which stands for a central bank digital currency. What's your take on that?
So we were the first state just last month. We actually got the Florida legislature to pass a law that says Florida does not recognize central bank digital currency, because some states were actually adding that to their uniform commercial code. You know, the federal government's studying this. We did the opposite and say we didn't. Now, the reason why we did that is because what the Federal Reserve has said is, well, you know, we're going to consult with Congress. We'll consult with the executive branch. We don't have a CBDC right now. And ideally, we would get authorization for Congress. Well, wait a minute. It's not ideally. You must get authorization from Congress. I don't think Congress would authorize it. So if they unilaterally try to do this, we're trying to provide protection for people here in Florida. I know Biden did executive order. They're studying it. I can tell you, if I'm president, we are not doing a central bank digital currency. I think that would be a huge, huge imposition on people's financial freedoms and financial privacy. And oh, by the way, what would the logical result of this be? If the central authority has oversight over this, of course they're going to start imposing ESG criteria. Oh, wait a minute. You filled up your gas tank three times this week. You can't do any more. The sky of how they would be able to manipulate this. So I see it as a massive transfer of power from individual consumers to a central authority. And I don't think that that's good for a free society. So I'm a no on central bank digital currency.
Sounds
great.
Good.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, Governor, I want to thank you for the time. I mean, we could go for hours here, but I know you only had an hour and we've gone over that. So I want to be respectful of your time. I know there's so many people who want to ask questions and
we should do it again. I mean, I think it was fun. I think this is great. And we'll make sure that we come back and do it again. This is a great platform. I mean, I would like to see other platforms going in the same direction, but you know, a healthy democratic society needs the robust debate. So I just want to thank everybody for listening in. And I'll just make that pitch again. You know, we want you on the team. We'd love for you to go to rondesantis.com and make a donation so that we can get this done on this nomination and win the election in November of 2024. God bless everybody. And thank you.
Well, thanks, Governor. And yeah, we have over 300,000 people in the room. It's really been pretty incredible. And, you know, we started with some technical issues because of the sheer scale and unprecedented nature of what we're doing. But it's not how you start, it's how you finish. And I think this finished really strong. So,
yeah, I think it's just really great for the people to hear directly from presidential candidates and to have it in a conversational tone. Which obviously results in, you know, it's going to be imperfect because it's not scripted, so but it's genuine, and I think that really gives the people an opportunity to understand who might be their president in a way that's real. So thank you very much for coming on and doing this.
And the invitation's open to any other candidates who might want to do this.
Absolutely, it is important for people to hear directly from candidates. So thank you for working with us on this historic event, and yeah, looking forward to future conversations and just having a great national dialogue.
Okay, that basically wraps it up there, I believe. Okay, over on Twitter, very interesting, kind of a historic thing. The governor of Florida announcing his candidacy for president of the United States right there on Twitter. And I'm just looking at some of your comments. We've been chatting during the whole thing. I'm happy I was able to figure out my own tech issues to be able to bring that to you live. I think it was an important thing to see. We you know, kind of heard what I would expect we would have heard, right? I mean, I don't know if there was anything necessarily kind of off the charts unusual in all of that, but other than the forum itself, we did see a whole lot of headlines crossing, of course, as this all went out. We saw that much of the legacy media was really kind of taking shots at the technical challenges they had. Apparently, it just crashed as soon as it went live. And there will be a lot of fun made of the whole situation, just only because, one, it's a competitor. Let's be very clear. Legacy media doesn't like Twitter, and they also do not like Elon Musk, not one single bit. I think the establishment, the elites have no use for Elon Musk. So this was a new thing to do. I give DeSantis credit for taking this on and deciding to announce this way. One challenge, of course, with it, and again, it's new, and I think that we have to cut everybody some slack, but I like to be able to see things. Like, I don't know about you. And I found myself listening too intently to Ron DeSantis's voice, which, you know, look, I'm unusual in that I am a trained classical singer, so I have a very sensitive ear. And when you're just hearing someone as opposed to looking at someone, if they don't have a really well-modulated voice, if it's too nasal, for example, then it kind of just sticks out at you. A lot of you were complaining that you thought he was boring. Yeah. You know, I think it's going to be one of his challenges. I don't think he's an exciting candidate, but a lot of people might say also, hey, you know, maybe I'm good with boring, given how exciting things have been. I personally think he's probably much smarter than he lets on. Not all that comes out. The guy went to like Harvard. Not that that means anything. Let's be very clear. I do believe the CEO of Anheuser-Busch went to Harvard, as did the former head of marketing there at Bud Light. She also went to Harvard. So not that that means anything. He went to Yale as well. He was part of JAG. So he's got this great educational background. He was in the military. And then he just went into politics. And so my one hesitancy with anybody who has spent a career in politics is just that. They're politicians. They've been in politics. And my own bias, I guess, having started my career in finance and having been a journalist and covered primarily financial markets, the economy, and politics through that lens, is that I really, 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 really wish we'd get somebody who understood something about politics itself. And forgive me, about business itself. I mean, that was one of the things that just encouraged me about Donald Trump. And I know you can pick apart, was he the best businessman, this, that, and the other. Look, I mean, the guy was in the field. So I think when it came to things like negotiation, et cetera, he kind of understood more in terms of the complexity of everything going on. Whereas some of these politicians, like, they just don't get it. It's a zero-sum game for them. And that's one of the challenges that we're facing right now as a nation, right now, as we like come upon the whole debt crisis, the threat of default. I mean, the idea that we're possibly looking at a default is pretty insane, but that's just part of the politics, shall we say. So this was an interesting medium. I'm glad that we were able to gather and talk through some of this. I did get some very interesting comments from so many of you. I'm actually trying to pull some of them up so that I can see them as we speak right now. Let me see if I can pull them into being. But again, I think that people are sort of underwhelmed. I mean, is that a fair thing to say? I know a lot of people are very nervous that maybe Donald Trump wouldn't be able to beat Joe Biden, although the polls show actually something quite different right now. I do think that there are fears about that. And so people are looking for some alternatives. And maybe Ron DeSantis could be it. The problem he's going to have is that he's just not really a natural politician. And by that, I mean somebody who's really comfortable on camera, comfortable with people, somebody who likes people. I made this comment in the live chat. I was saying that, you know, we really, I'm sorry, I'm just pulling the live chat up as I speak. It's like, you know, trying to do a few too many things at once. But anyway, as I think about his personality style, the one note of caution I would urge is that the most successful politicians are typically people who like people. I mean, think about, for example, Bill Clinton. Think about Ronald Reagan. Think about, you know, George Bush, right? Like, I think a lot of these politicians, like, really actually genuinely liked people. Donald Trump likes people. I mean, he really enjoys, you know, talking to people and having that human interaction. I am not under the impression that Ron DeSantis likes people in the same kind of way. Now, maybe it doesn't matter. I don't think Joe Biden likes people either. Let's be very clear. Hillary Clinton definitely doesn't like people. I don't think Kamala Harris really likes people. So some of them are kind of introverts. I suspect he's a little bit more of an introvert. And I just question, like, whether he's going to be able to kind of, you know, rough it up and get out there and do the rallies and go to the coffees, right? In New Hampshire, we heard from Steve Dace, who actually was just on this program the other day. Steve Dace, who's over at The Blaze, and he asked a question. And he was very complimentary, of course, to Elon Musk, because so many people, as you know, got their accounts shut down until Elon came in and kind of freed everybody and shut down for actually just sharing a story that turned out to be true. So that was all pretty nutty. I'm again reading your comments and you're laughing about what I said on The Voice thing. I'm not your average American in that sense. I spent way too many years studying music, went to a conservatory, et cetera, learned to speak a lot of languages and was taught how to sing in those languages without even having an accent, right? So I'm very focused on voice and tonality, and, you know, not being able to see him kind of just made me zero in on that like a little laser more than I would have liked to. So, yeah, I mean, if I could just give him a voice lesson or two, you know, start by plugging the nose. Anyway, I don't want to demean anything he's doing, because I do think let's all remember this right now, regardless of how it all shakes out. And I may sound very, very different in a couple of months. The important thing is we got people that are willing to run. Because who the heck, in all seriousness, who the heck wants that job? I mean, why would anybody take that on? I often thought that about Trump. Like, I mean, I guess he's got an ego, and so he wanted it for that reason. But who needs it? They're going to go after you. They're going to go after your family. They're going to go after you. I mean, we're full on banana republic right now. I mean, lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit that they're targeting Donald Trump with, including targeting him during March of 2024. That's when they want this trial to take place, when he's supposed to be out campaigning. He's calling it election interference. I don't know. I just look at it and say, who wants it? Really? I mean, you've got to be like very special to actually want that. And you got to make sure that, you know, you've led a pretty perfect life. And even if you have, they'll make it up, right? I mean, that's the whole opposition research thing. That's what we saw. Think about the Trump dossier. They made it up. I'm just pouring some water here in my, everybody's asking about my live free or die cup. You know what? This actually will be out soon. I do believe if you go over to my Instagram page or to my Facebook page that you can get it there. Tell me if you can't. Because, you know, we're doing a whole bunch of stuff now. The other thing is we're trying to get the email sort of more up and running. So go over, if you can, register at trishreganshow.com, trishreganshow.com, put your email in and we'll start sending, you know, there'll probably be like a little banner ad somewhere in those emails as we start sending the shows out and more news out, and you'll be able to click on it there. But yeah, I designed it myself, live free or die. My favorite expression in my home state that I grew up in, and it's signed by me. So thank you for asking about it. I know, a lot of you guys are pretty split. We got some real Trump fans here, and we've got not so many DeSantis fans. AIM saying that Ramaswamy is impressive. I'm going to agree with you on that. You know, I, again, appreciate that he's coming at this through a different lens. This is a guy, Vivek Ramaswamy, who built a couple of major businesses and then sold them for a heck of a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars. So he is a self-made guy. So right there, I kind of like that, because the sort of embeddedness that you have between business and politicians, I don't go for that. I don't like it. So I like the independence that he comes at all of this with. And the other thing that he's got going for him is that he's crazy smart. Like, I'll tell you, I interviewed him maybe a year and a half ago when his first book, Woke Inc., came out. And it's very rare that I'm almost at a loss for words. Like, I'm just sort of, you know, just digesting what somebody says. And usually I'm able to digest pretty quickly and come back with a follow-up question. But these were such thoughtful comments that I really hadn't heard articulated in such a way that I was like, you know, because I just found myself absorbing and so interested in what he was saying. And that's rare for me anyway. So I was like, oh, okay, this guy's pretty smart. And then when he announced that he was running, I thought, wow. And then he came on the show the other day. You can actually see that episode. We have that, Vivek Ramaswamy. And he's really, I think, top notch. And what encouraged me most about him running, 37 years old, self-made guy, tremendous education, wonderful story about his parents coming here to this country as immigrants and him being born here, but really living that American dream. And by the way, he's a classical pianist. Okay. So classical singer, you know, classical pianist. I'm like, okay, this guy's like, he's pretty spot on. So I'm encouraged to see somebody like that run, who's got real ideas, that has a background in something other than politics. It's why I was so struck by Trump's candidacy back in 2016, because this was somebody who was just coming with a different approach. And you know me, like, I read every tax policy. I'm like, wow, like, this is good. This is the best tax policy I've seen. So I'm going to have Vivek back on, because I want to talk with him a little bit more just about some of those things. Of course, some of the social issues, as you know, have been dominating the news nonstop, right? And so he's been quizzed about some of that. I don't love it. I mean, we talk about the social issues, you know, we have to. And I was saying earlier today on the program, the whole Target thing, which, by the way, is a business story, because Target's trading way down. They're getting the Bud Light treatment, and they're going to suffer from, I suspect, some serious boycotts and earnings issues. But the reason it's happening is because they're wading into this social territory, which companies really traditionally anyway didn't used to do. So that's become a big political issue, as one would suspect, because, well, you know what? That is that's something that really kind of, I think, gets people angry. And consequently, both sides are going to try and choose the issues that get them most angry. But are those the things that are going to affect us most in the future? Look, I think they will affect us, but we want to make sure that simultaneously we have somebody there in the Oval Office that understands the economy, understands business, understands human nature, right? Is personable. I think Vivek Ramaswamy has that going for him, as well as Donald Trump. Again, not everybody's cup of tea. I get it. Before you jump all over me, but I do think he had a je ne sais quoi. And there is no one that I've seen that can go out and command a room and command a stage with the same kind of excitement as him. And so whether you loved him, whether you hated him, you were still watching him. So that's a special talent that he has onto his own. I think it's going to be very, very hard to fill those shoes. So Vivek is one to watch, if not for this time around, maybe for 28. And I think he's actually aligned pretty decently closely with Trump. So I don't think he runs the risk of having sort of the MAGA base go, whoa, you know, we don't like you. So I would watch him just in terms of his future. I think that the guy's only 37 years old, right? So he's got a lot more that he could do and can do before he even gets to Ron DeSantis' age. I'm trying to see if I have any sound from him. Here, take a look right here. This was him on with Chuck Todd on NBC, and Chuck is pushing him on all this gender stuff. And by the way, Vivek, also the co-founder of Strive Funds, which is an asset management company designed to kind of be the non-woke, right? The non-ESG. Let's just value companies as they should be properly valued outside of all the ESG nonsense. So very smart guy in terms of financial markets business. But of course, you know, MSNBC wants to ask these questions. Take a look.
It isn't a spectrum.
I am.
You know this as a scientist?
Well, there's two X chromosomes if you're a woman, an X and a Y. That means you're a man.
So there's a biological research out there. There's a lot of scientific research out there that says gender is a spectrum.
Chuck, I respectfully disagree. Gender dysphoria for most of our history, all the way through the DSM-5, has been characterized as a mental health disorder. And I don't think it's compassionate to affirm that. I think that's cruelty. When a kid is crying out for help, what they're asking for is, you got to ask the question of what else is going wrong at home? What else is going wrong at school? Let's be compassionate and get to the heart of that, rather than playing this game as though we're actually changing our medical understanding for the last 100 years.
I go back to this. If a parent is dealing with a child that has these, that may have these issues, trust me, the parent, the last thing they want to do is consider something like this. But if that is what they think could help their child pursue happiness or they're not to kill themselves, why take away that option? Again, why shouldn't it be up to the parent?
So part of why parents now suddenly feel that way, let's ask ourselves that, Chuck, is we've created a culture that teaches parents that they're being bigoted or that they're bad people if they don't actually take those steps. So part of what I think is, listen, gender dysphoria for the rare few people who have suffered it is a condition of suffering. My question is,
okay, it goes on and on. But anyway, you get the idea. So he's been out in front on some of the social issues, but I would just say he's got the sort of economic business chops to back it up. Same thing with Donald Trump. I mean, you know, he knew which issues and he still knows which issues are going to play in Peoria, as they say. But he's got some heavyweight there behind him that's not just politics, politics, politics. So we need more of that. I mean, the governor of Virginia, who's actually a former private equity banker. He ran Carlyle Group. That's another interest. He's not in there. He's not putting his hat in the ring, but he would be another interesting person. I'm just looking for people that have something other than a political background because I'm so tired of it, really and truly tired of it. And I think you guys probably are too, right? We're on the same page on that. Like, no more politicians. And I don't consider Trump a politician in that classic sense. I think that that's actually been part of his issue, right? Because he's not sort of there to play the status quo, and he calls him out. And by the way, he too often actually says exactly what he thinks. And so he's not coached in that sense. I think the Ron DeSantis, again, I'm happy he's running. Believe me, I think the more people, the better, right? It helps elevate the conversation in so many different ways. But I don't get the sense that he's coming at things from a different lens. He, in some ways, feels like Trump light, and then just doesn't have the je ne sais quoi, as I mentioned earlier. So it's going to be an uphill battle for him, but never say never. And he, you know, who knows? Who knows? There's a lot of time between now and November 2024. So we shall see. I am so glad you came back with me for another live. This is a special edition live show here tonight. I just wanted to make sure that you saw that from Ron DeSantis. It's a big deal. It's kind of a moment in history. It's an important moment in the digital space. I do think that there are concerns, shall we say, over at Fox with Tucker wanting to go and do his show there. It would be very different, I guarantee you. I don't think he would do like the Spaces thing. I think he'd do the video. The video is important. It's part of telling a story, right? And communicating with someone, you want to see them. And I think Tucker would understand that. And maybe they'll get that up and running by the time he decides to go there. But I wonder, you know, like normally a candidate would go on to Fox News, right? And they would announce that they're running for president on Fox News. And that didn't happen this time. What do you know? Anyway, good to see you all. Thank you again. Make sure you subscribe if you haven't. Go over, check out my website. Don't hold it against me because we're redoing it. TrishReganShow.com. Just sign up for the email. I'd love to have you do that. And you'll get more alerts from us so that you know when I'm here. And for those of you that want this, I'm pretty sure it's on. We'll have to make sure that's working. I think it's on the Instagram store. Instagram. My handle over on Instagram is @Trish, TRISH_Regan. I'll see you soon.